It may be invisible to some or ever-present to others, but trauma entangles us all. Welcome to Traumatize, brought to you by Volare. Traumatize is a podcast that creates space and conversations to untangle the societal knots that keep us from addressing trauma after crime. For you, we want this podcast to be an experience, one where you leave understanding how you can be a crossing point to minimize the deeply painful and costly consequences of trauma, no matter who you are.
Welcome back to Traumatize, where we believe trauma is a common thread of the human experience and connection. And I'm Bridget Stump. As always, I like to have these conversations with my co-host, and sadly, she can't be here today, so I'll be flying solo with this one. But I'm still just really excited for the guests that we have joining us, and I think our listeners are going to get a lot out of this. With that, I'm going to go ahead and introduce today. We are really honored to be joined by our guest, Anna Boucher. She is an associate professor in public policy and comparative politics at the University of Sydney, as well as a public policy scholar, admitted solicitor, and global expert on migration, labor rights, and systems level inequality. So lots of stuff going on. Anna works at the intersection of law, public policy, and comparative politics, and she's really spent her career surfacing what I think are some of the more quieter, often hidden forms of harm that live inside institutions, from workplaces, dealing with exploitation, migration systems, and even leadership cultures inside of government itself. And along with her academic work, Anna has held senior leadership roles in the university, advised governments, and worked directly in legal practice with victim survivors of sexual assault and racialized trauma. And in 2026, she'll be undertaking a fellowship focused on trauma-informed leadership models within the Australian Public Service. I'm really excited to talk to you a little bit more about that. In this episode, we'll get to talk about what it means to lead and govern through a trauma-responsive lens where care, accountability, and structural change are really not at odds, but actually very deeply connected. So that is really just a high-level overview, Anna, of all the amazing things that you have done and are doing. And I'm just so grateful for your time and your willingness to share your talent with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on this terrific podcast.
Oh, thanks for being here. And we'll just jump right in with our first question. You know, this season, we've been focused on what we're referring to as champions of change. And this is really about people who are actively reshaping systems to be more trauma responsive and really to tackle some of the ways that trauma has caused harm in the way systems have been designed. So when you think about trauma in public institutions, I think specifically about some of the work you've done in workplaces, legal systems, and now even more so in governments, how do you see trauma showing up in ways that often go unaddressed or unseen in these institutions?
So thanks for great questions. First, I think trauma can take a few different forms in public institutions. It can relate to the way in which traumatic incidences are responded to or not. For instance, whether government or institutional action is taken against a particular event. So one example in Australia is the robo-debt crisis, where welfare beneficiaries were inappropriately issued debts. Second is in which trauma can occur is the process of public institutions. So for instance, the way bureaucracies are run or the way leadership engages may be dehumanizing or lacking in empathy. And this can lead to traumatic outcomes, even if the intention is positive. So this has more to do with leadership styles, human design, than the actual outcomes necessarily. And finally, in terms of the law, we know that aspects of the adversarial system that exist in Australia and the United States can be inherently traumatic for victim survivors. For instance, as much as we might try to reform these systems, core aspects of the legal process, like cross-examination, are inherently traumatic. Still, there are ways we might work on this, for instance, the way we take advice from clients that can decrease the traumatic nature of the legal process.
Yeah, it's so true. I'm thinking about just like the principles of trauma-informed systems and how do we center like choice and agency, right? Empowerment is such a key pillar of how people feel supported sort of post-trauma. And at least from our experience, like we've designed a lot of legal systems and other formal systems to not center agency and choice of the person most impacted. And so that's a really good thing to highlight. And I kind of teased this a little bit in your intro, but I know you're about to undertake a fellowship that's focused specifically on trauma-informed leadership within Australian Public Service. I'm like, what do I need to do to be a part of this with you? It just sounds like so cool. And when we talk about trauma-responsive leadership, what does that look like for you in practice as you're about to embed this principle into the Australian Public Service and government?
Well, I haven't started the fellowship yet, so I guess that's what I'll find out. But I'm doing it with the Australian New Zealand School of Government and the Australian Public Service Commission, who are basically the HR for the Australian Public Service. And I'll be working with Lion agencies, and these are agencies that implement and administer policies. So I'm interested in how the integrated leadership system of the AEPS binds its senior executive in an understanding of trauma or doesn't, and where there might be a need for improvement. Not only in terms of the service delivery, but how they might assist their staff in minimizing the risk of vicarious trauma in the work that they do. And this is important because it keeps staff healthy and it minimizes workers' compensation and other forms of negligence claims. So if you think about the kind of work that the Australian Commonwealth Government does, a lot of it covers very hard issues. This might include the intergenerational trauma of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians, sexual violence, modern slavery, deportation, and all of these areas ideally should bring in a trauma-informed lens in both leadership and staff management. Some ideas that have come up so far are, for instance, and not dissimilar from what we might attempt in legal practice, rotating staff who are working on traumatic material, looking at the degree of mental health support, debriefing as a group on any traumatic material that might come up, either policy or service delivery, potentially forms of somatic support for staff, whether that's gym membership or somatic therapy, maybe some creative interventions, and investigating also the capacity, because often it's not just about the rotation, but whether you have capacity to rotate based on whether there are sufficient staff available. So there's a lot of different factors, and I'm sure as I embark on the fellowship, more ideas will come up.
Yeah, I can't wait to sort of learn more from you on what kind of comes to the surface and what folks get to learn from you in that fellowship. It is actually bringing up for me a former season we did where we looked at sort of invisible spaces where there are these helpers like supporting individuals impacted by trauma in kind of like invisible ways. And we talked to chief of staff for one of the elected offices here in the U.S., and they described supporting their boss during times when their district was impacted by mass shooting related to domestic terrorism and how no one trains like staffers on the Hill, right, that you might be talking to constituents who just lost their loved one, their grandparents, right? And just the trauma exposure and really the vicarious trauma that comes from some of these public service positions that maybe they didn't even expect. And so this is really interesting to me to think about how do we build caretaking strategies into public service, right? And especially these really important positions that often I think get impacted in these really unseen ways. And the thing you highlighted that's just so important is the power of the pause. Like those folks having a debrief, having a space to process with colleagues and supportive structures is just, it's so critical in so many leadership roles, but I think particularly in spaces where the impact on the staff carrying the load can be a little disenfranchised. So that's very interesting to me. And I'll be curious to see where that goes, Anna. One thing that I'm also just like intrigued to get your perspective on is you just have such a cross-sector perspective through academia, law firms, government advisory roles. How does trauma show up differently across these spaces from your view? And what do you think leaders most often kind of misunderstand about their role in either perpetuating that harm or interrupting it?
How does it come up differently across those sectors? Well, obviously, in public policy, you're looking at often at the big picture. You're looking at policies across an entire population. Whereas in the academy, of course, you have institution-wide policy, but it's also about the relationship between academic and student or academic and academic. So it's more individual. And then in law, primarily, unless we're working on class actions, it's also between the individual client and the attorney. So the level is different. When you're looking at institutional trauma, that can be very challenging because the responses that work for some individuals might not for others. And you've also got those historical legacies that play into the appropriate responses, and you may or may not be aware of them. So one example in Australia would be any policy around adoption or fostering will have to factor in Australia's history with the stolen generation, where Aboriginal children were removed from their parents and put in institutional care. That has created deep wounds in the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander population. And any form of removal moving forward will have a similar resonance. So that is nationwide, policy-wide issues. You have to really be aware of that historical legacy that trauma may carry.
Yeah. And I'm even thinking about like leaders within those systems not necessarily recognizing that it doesn't require like a physical taking of someone's body to sort of put them back in a place of feeling threat and harm to choice, agency, what might feel like, you know, sort of very similar to being stolen, right? When you think about the generational harm that comes from that experience on an entire population of people, but like threats in the workplace can often feel like as severe. And I think leaders don't always recognize that the way they communicate, the power they hold can really bring up for people that have these histories of trauma, similar feelings of threat and lack of choice and agency and freedom. That's something that we've seen in leadership is just kind of this aha moment or awareness where leaders realize that when they are supporting teams or not supporting teams, whatever their sort of impact is on the folks they're responsible for, that they're not just dealing with that person in the moment, but they're dealing with the entire history of that person's lived experience. And this has been a bit of an aha moment for me. So I'm curious for you, having been under kind of beneath the surface in so many spaces, whether that's exploitation, inequality, and these institutional blind spots that you talk about, when you look back on your work, was there a moment for you, kind of this thing that you remember where it all clicked and you realized what you were seeing wasn't just like a policy failure, but really that trauma was embedded in these systems and was impacting how people experience systems and leaders?
One thing I've noticed is that with time, people can become detached from the people they're serving and even perhaps judgmental of them. And this can be because they are protecting themselves from the trauma they feel that person possesses or might on some level flow into them. And I think the term is often compassion fatigue. So professional language, whether it's policy jargon, legalese, or academic language, can be a form of separation from the person who we see as traumatized. And many people feel in this way that they are independent of the trauma and it won't infect them. But really often, this, I believe, is people's attempt to insulate themselves from the trauma to dissociate from it. And of course, that is a fallacy because all of us in our life will experience some form of trauma, even if it is not of the magnitude of our clients. For this reason, I think it's really important for leaders to go into their own shared trauma, to heal from their own trauma, both so they have more empathy for the people they serve, but also to be more effective leaders.
Yeah, it's so true. And it's interesting, you know, we've been in various kind of different leadership spaces, and we've really tried to push this narrative that trauma education and what we now think about as resiliency training, right? It's like preparing for grief, loss, suffering, trauma. It's like preparing for what is part of the lived experience for everyone, including all leaders, should be a core competency. Like we should be teaching leaders about building supportive, resilient teams to combat high-risk environments that cause vicarious trauma, but also just trauma exposure generally in the folks they're supporting. In the same way, we would be teaching leadership about change management, right? And other sort of tools. And so it's really cool to see you thinking, I think, so much like almost like a systems thinker about this in ways that I think is quite unusual. The thing I've always thought getting connected with you, Anna, is that you're a bit of a unicorn, if I'm being honest. I really feel that. And like some of this is my own perspective. Like I remember feeling very alone as like an early kind of baby lawyer and like getting questions about trauma and how I'm seeing behavior and responses in clients and how that's different when they're engaging systems and often similar to how they were experiencing the original harm. And I felt so alone and like starting to connect these dots with how lawyers experienced lack of trauma education and then how I was experiencing that as a leader in teams. And you just seem to sort of have it all figured out and connected already. And so I think that's really unusual for someone to have such a diverse perspective on the importance of trauma-responsive approaches in all of these sectors. And I wonder if you also feel a little bit like a unicorn in some of the work that you're doing.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I do sometimes feel these are new ways of thinking, and yet in some regards, very old. If we look at a lot of scholarship, and I'm reading this for the ANZOC Fellowship from First Nations cultures, they have for a long time thought about how trauma comes into leadership models. But yes, I think in regards to Western-focused systems and very mainstream institutions, these are relatively new concepts.
Yeah, and you're just putting them all together, I think, in various kind of sectors of our lives that makes a lot of sense, but I think is unexpected, and I really appreciate that. And of course, you've spent your days close to harm in the different roles that you've played, whether that's harm caused through generational trauma exposure, power, oppression, right? All of these things that you've talked about. And what we know is that policymaking to combat that is slow. It takes a lot of time to undo the harm that systems have caused by design. So knowing that, what keeps you committed to this work, given that it takes a lot of time and patience? And what sort of moments of resilience or maybe even humanity remind you that it's worth the time that it takes?
So I grew up in a family with a very strong matriarchal figure, my grandmother, and she inspires me every day, even after her death. So that would be the first thing. I would say that even though there's a lot of sadness in the world, I think when we hear a student say, your teaching helped me, or a client says, your legal advice assisted me, changed my life, or someone in government says, your ideas helped us with this or that legal reform, we know it's worth it. And being buttressed by others and buttressing others is really important when we work on hard topics. In addition, like many people who work on difficult issues, I have my own self-care practices. I meditate every day. I keep a gratitude journal. And I do martial arts 3 to 4 times a week, boxing and a form of Iranian martial arts called Pallavana. And my Iranian martial arts instructor, Dr. Kashi Asad, he taught me that when life is hard, you take it to the mat. And so I think if our body is strong, our minds and soul can be strong as well.
That's so beautiful. And I'm having a reaction. I think, you know, obviously sorry for the loss of your grandmother. And it's such an important way of highlighting that we often are so inspired by the people we're closest to, and they serve as big motivations for us to like put good into the world. And I'm inspired listening to that. I have a 7-year-old daughter myself. And so something I spend a lot of time thinking about is like, how do we model for future generations inspiration? And it sounds like your grandmother did that for you. And it's interesting. You practice a lot of the things we kind of teach other leaders to be thinking about, practices of gratitude and mindfulness, and like, how do we channel that into overall mental, physical health in our lives? And I hope people that are listening can take a little bit from that. Like, you can be an amazing rock star like Anna and do all these things and still find time to take care of yourself when you protect that time and really value it. And I'm going to leave you with our final question, which has been kind of an anchor that we've been tethered to with all the guests this season. And it's been really beautiful to see how folks answer, but we've been asking everyone that's joined us, what's one thing about trauma or even healing, the other side of that, that the public may not understand, and what would change if they did?
I recently read something by Erin Carpenter, who wrote the book Life Reinvented, that speaks to the deep, repeated nature of trauma, of what we might call complex or developmental childhood trauma. And he says, while a survivor of a single trauma event, like a rape as an adult, may feel that she is not herself, the survivor of chronic trauma may lose the sense that they even have a self. And I think this goes to the eviscerating nature of long-term, especially childhood trauma or intergenerational trauma, that can shape a person's life or even a family's entire existence. And the way in which trauma impacts citizens, especially when it compounds from childhood onwards, is poorly understood by the general public, sometimes not even understood by survivors themselves, unless they have had the opportunity to heal that trauma.
Yeah, that really hits me in a really profound way. And it's something we spend a lot of time thinking about, is like, if we can create a shared language over the consequences of unaddressed trauma, particularly for young people, we could probably prevent a lot of future suffering. And I really believe that deeply. And so thank you for the work that you're doing, Anna, to try and shift that and create these spaces where we can be really responsive to the harm that's been caused, hopefully in the hope of avoiding more harm in the future. And we're so grateful for the work that you're doing and also for joining us. I just want to take this moment to thank you and also thank our listeners for tuning in and joining us for season 4 of Traumatize. And of course, as you listen, you can rate, subscribe, and review the Traumatize podcast wherever you listen. Thank you for joining us, and we can't wait to continue this conversation with more untangling. Thanks so much, Anna.
Thank you so much for having me.
This episode of Traumatize is over, but this podcast is just one of our many resources. Volare welcomes all survivors of crime and their supporters. So please visit us at volare-empowers.org to learn more about how to access our trauma education and how to partner with us to create empowering experiences for survivors.